For an interactive version of this episode, subscribe to Criminal AF, available wherever you listen to podcasts, or visit www.criminalafpod.com. On August 6, 1969, just days before the Tate-LaBianca murders, Manson family member Bobby Beausoleil was found by police sleeping in the back of a Fiat on the side of Highway 101 in San Luis Obispo. When questioned, Bobby stated that the car had broken down the night before and he was waiting for daylight to fix it. Police knew this was a lie, as the Fiat was reported stolen from the home of a murder victim. Bobby was taken into custody and questioned about his possible involvement in the murder of Gary Hinman. Hinman was born December 24, 1934 in Colorado. He was known as a Renaissance figure of the hippie movement, a political activist, Zen Buddhist, musician, piano teacher, who was working towards his PhD in sociology at UCLA, and he was also a Manson family associate who allegedly had a mescaline lab in his basement. Hinman was found dead in his home at 964 Old Topanga Canyon Road on July 31, 1969. Slashed across the left side of his face and stab wounds through his heart. Why the murder of Hinman, who was a friend of Beausoleil, occurred is up for debate. Charlie himself said it was because Hinman owed the family money, which he refused to give. But Beausoleil himself gave a more detailed explanation. Charles Manson had befriended members of the Straight Satan Motorcycle Club and used them as protection after he shot a small-time drug dealer named Bernard Crow, who Manson thought was also a member of the Black Panthers. Manson believed he had killed Crow and feared the Black Panthers would seek retribution. In fact, Crow, who was not a member of the Black Panthers, survived the shooting and went into hiding. Beausoleil, who was trying to impress both Manson and the Straight Satans, set up a drug deal with his friend Gary Hinman on behalf of the motorcycle club. Beausoleil purchased the drugs from Hinman and delivered the goods to the Straight Satans. The drugs allegedly turned out to be bad, and the club demanded their money back from Beausoleil. Manson had told Beausoleil to return to Hinman, along with Susan Atkins and Mary Brunner, both of whom had a sexual relationship with Hinman, and force him to hand over $20,000 Manson believed he had. For 3 days, the trio kept Hinman hostage in his own home, demanding the money, with Beausoleil roughing up Hinman while the girls would care for him. At some point, with Hinman still not cooperating, a call was made to Manson. Charlie arrived, along with Bruce Davis. Hinman excitedly yelled, "Charlie!" He was happy to see Manson, who Hinman liked and thought his presence meant a reprieve from the abuse. Allegedly, Manson stormed in and sliced Hinman across the face with a Confederate sword and demanded Hinman sign over his cars and the home to Manson. Unknown to Charlie, Beausoleil had already convinced Hinman to do so. Manson left as quickly as he arrived. For the remainder of the weekend, Beausoleil and the girls were trying to fix the gash on Hinman's face, with Hinman persistent that he needed to go to the hospital. Finally, Beausoleil called Manson and said, "Look, man, you left me with this problem. You came and cut the guy. There was no need for that. It's your problem." Manson responded back, "You handle it. You know what you need to do as well as I do." Beausoleil then grabbed his knife and stabbed Hinman twice through his heart. Beausoleil, Atkins, and Brunner then staged a home to appear as if the Black Panthers had killed Hinman in retaliation for the Crow shooting. They drew a panther paw print on the wall in Hinman's blood and wrote the words, "Political Piggy." After Beausoleil was arrested for the murder of Hinman, Manson panicked. He felt that Beausoleil would pin the murders of Hinman and Bernard Crow on him, as at the time, Manson didn't know that Crow was still alive. Who came up with the plan is up for debate, but the stage was set. 3 days after Beausoleil's arrest, the family would commit copycat murders at the Tate and LaBianca homes in order to prove that Beausoleil didn't kill Hinman, as these apparently similar murders were committed while Beausoleil was in custody. Police didn't pick up on the similarities, and the rest is history. Terry Melcher, the son of Doris Day and his girlfriend Candace Bergen, lived at 10050 Cielo Drive before Sharon Tate and Roman Polanski. He had made his mark on the music industry by producing the first two albums from The Byrds, as well as hits from The Beach Boys. It was this connection that Terry had met Charles Manson. Beach Boy Dennis Wilson invited Melcher to his house when the family was staying there. Along with Wilson, Melcher's associate, Greg Jacobson, became fascinated with Charlie's philosophy and lifestyle and began urging Terry to record him. After a couple of meetings with Manson at Melcher's Cielo Drive home, Jacobson talked Melcher and a music executive into coming down to Spahn's Movie Ranch to hear Manson, Bobby Beausoleil, and the girls play and discuss the possibility of doing a documentary. A friend of Melcher's recalls, "Once Terry got to Spahn Ranch, he just wanted to get the hell out of there. It was filthy and very obvious that there was no talent. He sat and listened to Manson's girls while Charlie played the guitar. He felt like he had to get out and tried to make a graceful exit." During this audition, an associate of the family was belligerently drunk and was making a scene. Manson proceeded to beat the man bloody in front of his guests. Melcher, Jacobson, and the music executive left the ranch, never to return again. According to Jacobson, he stated, "I think Terry showed some interest in Manson's music, but there was never any 'yes, we will record you.' It was like that was the preliminaries, and nothing ever came of it." But Manson saw it another way. He claimed that Melcher made some big promises and never came through. To Charlie, it became clear that Melcher had failed him. It was Terry Melcher who denied him his chance to play his music for the world. This perceived slight would fester in Manson's mind for months. Another brush with fame fell through as well. Phil Kaufman, who had befriended Manson in Terminal Island Prison, had connections to the music industry, specifically a man named Gary Stromberg, who worked at Universal. Kaufman told Manson that upon his release, he would introduce Manson to Stromberg. Since Manson was to be released prior to Kaufman, he advised Manson to take some time to brush up on his songs, and when Kaufman was released, he would set up the meeting. However, Manson ignored the advice, and after starting his commune with the first four women, Manson made his own introductions to Stromberg. As expected, the audition went horrible. Despite this, Manson welcomed Kaufman into the family upon his release, and Kaufman shared in a plethora of women. They would party at Kaufman's friend's house, Harold True, on Waverly Drive, and spent countless nights there, playing music, doing drugs, and having orgies, and True would become an associate of the family for a time. Eventually, as time wore on, Manson could sense that Kaufman wasn't buying into the whole free love, anti-establishment concept that Manson was trying to create. The two had a falling out, so Kaufman left, and so did Manson's real connection to the music industry. Manson's anger would continue to build. According to the theory, Manson wanted revenge on the ones who he felt slighted him. Even though he knew Terry Melcher had moved, he targeted the Cielo Drive house as a message to send to Melcher. He did the same with Kaufman. Because Harold True's house was now vacant, Manson chose the house next door to send his message. But what about the murder of Gary Hinman? How does that play into all of this? Gary was a talented musician and piano player. According to Mother Mary herself, Mary Brunner, who was present during the Hinman murder, Manson wanted Hinman to join his band and felt Hinman's experience would help the band get a record deal. So Manson sent Hinman's friend, Bobby Beausoleil, to convince him, along with Susan Atkins and Mary Brunner, to seduce him. But after 3 days, Hinman still refused, infuriating Manson, who showed up, sliced his face, and ordered him killed. The drug burn theory has always had traction. From the moment police arrived on the scene at 10050 Cielo Drive, it was apparent that drugs may have played a vital role in the deaths of Sharon Tate, Jay Sebring, Abigail Folger, and Wojtek Frykowski. Inside Sebring's Porsche, police found a bag of marijuana, vials of cocaine, and a brown gummy substance believed to be a narcotic. Inside the house, sporadic locations with marijuana, capsules of MDA, brown, green, and yellow identified tablets throughout. During their autopsies, it was said that Tate was found with a trace amount of THC in her system, but was redacted from her final autopsy report as to not sully her name. They didn't find any drugs in Jay Sebring's system, but they also didn't test for MDA. Abigail Folger had 2.4 milligrams of MDA in her bloodstream, and Wojtek Frykowski had 0.6 milligrams of MDA in his urine. According to the book, The Manson File, by Nicholas Schreck, the murders at Cielo Drive occurred because Tex Watson wanted to muscle his way on a large drug deal going on at the home between Frykowski, Folger, and Sebring, and a supplier. Watson, a small-time drug dealer, got wind of the deal and that Frykowski and Sebring, with Folger as their financier, were about to make a major push into LA drug scene, and Tex and the family wanted them out of the picture. According to Sebring's receptionist, there was to be a major drug transaction of mescaline and cocaine at Cielo Drive on the night of the murders between a mafia supplier and Frykowski and Sebring. The receptionist confirmed that the delivery had taken place, but no large quantities of drugs were found after their murders, leading people who believe in a drug burn theory that Tex Watson and the girls made off with the drugs. It goes a bit deeper than just Cielo Drive. It was also believed that the murder of Gary Hinman, who was a dealer and allegedly had a mescaline lab in his basement, was killed for the same reason. It's also alleged that the victims of the Tate murders and the Manson family knew each other, or at least knew of each other. In Michael Caine's autobiography, he states that he attended a party hosted by Mama Cass Elliott of the Mama and Papas and was introduced to Sharon Tate and Jay Sebring. At the same party, he was also introduced to Charles Manson, Tex Watson, and some of the girls, meaning that the Manson family was important enough in that inner circle to be given an introduction. Abigail Folger and Wojtek Frykowski were also frequent guests of Mama Cass's parties. It was alleged that a day prior to the murders, Manson himself showed up at Cielo Drive to sell Frykowski and Sebring cocaine and marijuana. Manson showed them the product and was beaten up by the two men and kicked off the property. Did they steal Manson's drugs in the beating? In retaliation, Manson ordered the murders of everyone inside that house, with Frykowski, the dealer, and Folger, the financier, receiving the majority of the brutality. But how does this fit in with the LaBiancas? It is believed that Tex Watson, Jay Sebring, and Rosemary LaBianca all had connections in the wig industry, with Tex formerly working as a wig salesman, Sebring in the hair industry, and Rosemary in the beauty industry. Rosemary's wealth far exceeded what her company was believed to provide, and it has been alleged that Rosemary was running a drug operation out of her mobile and storefront dress shops, but this was only corroborated by anonymous sources. To put this all together, Gary Hinman, a prominent dealer who had a mescaline lab in his basement, Frykowski and Folger had a direct line to sell and distribute MDA, and Rosemary LaBianca had a drug operation run out of her dress shops. Now they are all dead, and it would leave Tex Watson, Charles Manson, and the family as the main distributors of drugs in their area. MK Ultra was a program facilitated by the CIA officially from 1953 to 1973 in which the CIA would conduct experiments on individuals, sometimes unknowingly, to assess the use of LSD and other drugs for mind control, counterintelligence, and psychological torture. The origin of MKUltra was approved by then CIA Director Alan Dulles to develop techniques that could be used against the Soviets, China, and North Korea. But before we could use the techniques on our enemies, we had to test them on our own people. The program initially used 150 human subjects to conduct experiments using psychedelic drugs, paralytics, and electroshock therapy. The total number of human subjects may never be known, as the CIA destroyed most of their documents related to MKUltra in 1973. The tests were mainly conducted at hospitals, universities, and prisons throughout the US and Canada. Under the direction of chemist Sidney Gottlieb, it was believed he would be able to harness LSD's mind-altering effects for the use in brainwashing, psychological torture, and implanting false memories, and its ultimate goal, creating the perfect assassin. He oversaw studies at notable universities such as Columbia and Stanford University. Gottlieb also conducted experiments in mescaline, heroin, MDMA, methamphetamines, and mushrooms. MKUltra eventually branched off into more seedy laboratories, including what they called safe houses, in a side project MKUltra called Operation Midnight Climax. It was in these locations that prostitutes employed by the CIA would lure men into the safe house and lace their drinks with mind-altering drugs, while agents monitored from behind a two-way mirror from another room. These experiments were conducted primarily in San Francisco, California, in New York City, and it was in 1967 when Manson would become involved. Manson's parole officer, a man by the name of Roger Smith, was a Berkeley doctoral student who was part of a federally funded LSD research program through his work at the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic, which possibly answers the question that, as Manson's parole officer, why didn't he send Manson back to prison for his drug use? Another man, Lewis West, who was also part of the program through the Free Medical Clinic, took ownership of a worn-down Victorian home next to the clinic and set it up as a hippie crash pad to further study the mind-altering effects of LSD. Which now brings us full circle. Lewis West worked for CIA chemist Sidney Gottlieb, the head of MKUltra. Now let's connect the dots. Roger Smith was Manson's parole officer. Smith also worked for the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic, which received federal funding through the CIA. Smith worked alongside researcher Lewis West, who directly worked for Sidney Gottlieb, the head of MKUltra. Manson and his commune of runaways and drug addicts would eventually leave San Francisco for Los Angeles, another parole violation which he didn't go back to jail for. This move would appear to end his involvement in the MKUltra program. However, sometime in late 1968, a man by the name of Alan Rose, an assistant researcher for the Haight-Ashbury Free Medical Clinic, would make his way to Spahn Ranch and would fully immerse himself within the commune for a period of 4 months. What interest would the CIA have in Manson and the hippie movement? They were all about peace, love, and free thinking, weren't they? To an extent. They were also anti-government, conducted violent protests against the war in Vietnam, criticized middle-class values and expectations, and to the CIA, were a problem to the way of life in America and to the way the American government conducted business. They had to stop the spread of the hippie movement. Insert MKUltra, Charles Manson, and his LSD-fueled family. One would be hard-pressed to argue against the hippie movement ending on the hot summer nights of August 9th and August 10th, 1969. This episode of Criminal AF Direct was written and produced by me, Dave Jari. For an unfiltered, interactive version of this episode with myself and co-host Garrett Corder, subscribe to Criminal AF or follow the link in the episode description. follow at Criminal AF Pod on Instagram, Twitter, TikTok, Facebook, and YouTube. As always, thank you for listening.